can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. No is the saddest experience you'll ever know. Yes, it's the saddest experience you'll ever know. Because one is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. One is the loneliest number that you'll ever know. It's just no good anymore since you went away. Now I spend my time just making rhymes yesterday.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Cheryl Wolper. How
yes.
are you?
I'm
Welcome
okay.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. It's great to be here with you. This is Tom Benedek on Blog Talk Radio, I'm the author of Peloponnesia, a new novel, out on Trithemius Press, and it's a Hollywood story which takes place in a plush corner of development hell. And I'm speaking with Cheryl Wolper, best-selling author. Your new book is out this month. Congratulations, Cheryl.
Thanks. It's, you know, it's nerve-wracking.
It's nerve-wracking?
Yeah, well, it's always great for me anyway, great fun to write a novel. But I'm a terrible person at promoting anything I do, so that part of it is hell.
Oh, well, you know, I think it's something that you're probably better than you think you are. And the title of your book is Anne of Hollywood?
Yeah. You know, do you know sort of the backstory on this?
I do, but the people who are listening might not, so you should tell them.
Okay,
tell
well,
us the backstory.
I was obsessed with the Tudors on Showtime. Did you ever watch that series?
Yeah, sure.
And
sure.
You know, it was Showtime's very sexy take on the Tudors, but the sexiest part of it was when Anne Boleyn was featured, which was Henry VIII's second wife. And I became obsessed with her, and then I realized that the reason I was obsessed was because she was the ultimate cautionary tale about the upside and the downside that comes when you hook up with a powerful man. And I realize I've been hearing those stories for the last 20 years from my girlfriends who have dated, you know, basketball stars or rock stars or movie guys or CEOs or, you know, Wall Street guys, whatever. And that not that much has changed in 500 years, except, as I say, shorter skirts and iPhones. So I decided to write a book that was Anne and Henry living in Los Angeles in 2012.
Well, it's a fantastic idea. And when did you write it? You wrote it 2 years ago or last year?
No, I wrote it fairly quickly because I'd been thinking about the idea for a long time, and I read so many books to research the 16th century. Because what I did was I took the characters from Tudor England and I found their modern-day counterparts. For example,
uh-huh.
Thomas Cromwell, who obviously at one point befriended the Boleyn family and then later basically set Anne up to be killed. In 2012, who would that be? And it's a woman. It's Theresa Cromwell. And we know women like this in Hollywood or in L.A. or any place,
yeah,
Washington
definitely,
or New York.
Definitely.
Very, very ambitious women who are very charming. But as someone said, and I wish I knew the name of this person who said this about someone else, that these type of women are so charming that when they're standing right in front of you, you forget that you can see right through them. And that's the kind of charm and ambition that my Teresa Cromwell has. So anyway, that part of it was fun, and I almost felt like I was channeling Anne Boleyn, as scary as that thought may be. So the book was written, you know, really quite quickly, and so.
And
you know,
who is your Henry? Who is your Henry? I mean, how do you see your Henry in this world of Hollywood today? Because to me, it feels like the world of Hollywood is sort of, you know, diminished. They're very powerful. There are rich people, and there are people, you know, have made fortunes. But it feels like it's diminished. The celebrity has somehow diminished this world of the town that we know.
I think you're right about that. We should talk about that in a minute, because I'm fascinated by that. But Henry is somebody who has the resume of Rupert Murdoch, but is 40 years old and looks like Paul Newman in HUD. And he's running for governor of California. That's my Henry. And the reason that I wanted him to be 40 and the reason I wanted him to have all of that, both attractiveness and wealth, is because I think the ultimate king in contemporary society is someone who not only has power, but is on the verge of getting even more. Obama in 2007, Clinton in his earlier years, Warren Beatty when he was younger, these are guys, or even George Clooney at one point in his career, these are guys who at a certain point in their life, if they walked into a room, they could practically change the molecular structure of the room just by walking into it because of the power they have and the new wave of power that they were about to ride, and everybody wanted a piece of it. And that's the kind of sort of alpha male I wanted to explore. I wanted to explore power, basically. And so I had to create a character who was at the beginning of that kind of ride. So that's my Henry. But,
It sounds fascinating. And is she beheaded? Is at the end of the story?
Is Anne killed?
Yeah.
What's
Anne's fate in the story?
Well, you know, they can't chop off your head in 2012, but they can kill you in other ways. And when you're dealing with these powerful men, and by the way, I find these men fascinating. So this is not, I'm not demonizing the man at all. In fact, there's one chapter from Henry's point of view, which is towards the end of the book. And people tell me it's their favorite chapter. Because it gives that world and that place of power kind of, we get a different perspective because he's telling it you know, with the good and the bad from his side. So you know, he's not going to kill her, but when you're that powerful, you basically can have what you want. If you want to get custody of your kid, you probably can get it. If you want to kill somebody's career, you probably can do that. I'm not saying that that's what he does exactly, but there is the potential to be a leverage abuser. And so what happens with Anne is that she goes from having this wonderful life. And by the way, a lot of I have girlfriends who for a while lived a very posh, wonderful life when they hooked up with these guys. And then at a certain point, the plug was pulled. And it's a very abrupt, you know, descent.
If you see the town, in a place like Los Angeles, you probably say this, you know, in cities large and small, women who are seeking love, but they're also seeking some kind of a setup,
mm-hmm.
and you know, there seems, you know, it's almost like there's two the kind of person who is looking for a relationship, and they care that the person they're with would be a good provider, but they might care just as much who the person is as a person. And so the component of love and like and long-term relationship weighs in more heavily or completely than the power or luxury that the partner might be able to provide.
Well, except I do think a certain amount of power.
How do you weigh those things?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Both things come out of power?
No, I was just going to say there's a certain amount of power that's so intoxicating. It's like being around it is like being on a drug. And that's something that these people have to deal with. I haven't been around anybody running for president.
So
but I imagine
there's a kind of person who is sort of addicted or feel has, you know, that the drug of that the power that being around a powerful person is as important as who that person might be? Is that what that is?
I don't even think you're thinking clearly. And by the way, I should also say that I don't think there's just one king. I think every community, in a way, has a king. I grew up in a factory town in Massachusetts, but there was basically a king of that town. You know, he drove a Corvette, and his, you know, he took over his dad's construction business. And, you know, I mean, there's always that kind of guy in every community. Maybe in Montana, it's a cowboy. But it's the same paradigm, obviously to a different degree. But in my book, I think, you know, you're asking like an interesting question, like what's the deal with these women and why are they drawn to this guy? And on a certain level, I do think it's almost chemical because it is intoxicating to be around that kind of power. But I also think they think that they're going to be saved in a certain way. And Don Simpson, you remember Don Simpson?
Yeah. Don Simpson, the great and legendary producer and user of drugs and women.
Yes, who
he produced Top Gun and
Beverly Hills Cop.
Yeah, some legendary films in his time.
With his partner Jerry Bruckheimer. I worked with him for a while, and before he died, we were working on this project, and it involved women. Well, actually, it involved basketball groupies. You know, those girls who hang out and want to hook up with, you know, NBA players, and there was tons of research that had been done on this, and he gave me all the transcripts of the interviews. And he and I were talking about it one day, and we were talking about girls that come to Los Angeles or, you know, other big cities, and they're young and they're pretty. They're not talented actresses. They're not extraordinary-looking models. They're not girls with college educations. They're just pretty girls who arrive here. And he would say that when they hit town at 20, they feel invincible because they get tons of attention and doors are open and party invitations are flying and in their direction. And then by the time they hit 30, this was his way of describing it, you can see the panic in their eyes when they realize that all their beauty bought them was a short run on a crowded field. So for those kind of girls, the opportunity to hook up with a king feels like salvation. It's either, you know, it's the alternative is what? Get a job, deal with the abyss.
But don't some of them kind of meet some guy who they, or person who they really, you know, who they fall in love with, who may not offer the, you know, ideal accoutrements of power, but they just fall into a relationship with them?
Oh, and I believe in that. I think those
happy.
Are the people who survive and survive well. If you can fall in love and you find your niche wherever it is, and by the way, I kind of end the book that way. I think that Anne, you know, is fine going back to a smaller, quieter life. Doesn't mean she's not ambitious, but she taps into her own strength. Or I call it her inner Tina Turner. You know, I remember when Tina Turner and Ike divorced, she's like, okay, I take all the money, take the houses, I'm just walking out of this courtroom and I'm doing my next chapter on my own. And it's kind of that kind of strength that I think an Anne Boleyn would have in 2012. If she had the opportunity in the 16th century to live, I don't care if they sent her to a convent.
I think there are a lot of powerful men who prefer powerful women who, you know, who know how to manage them to some extent and can manage the relationship and create their own place in the balance of power that makes sense, and not just from a physical beauty standpoint, but from other standpoints. But I think that story, the story you're telling, resonates, and I think this idea that power, you know, the attraction of power and the attraction to powerful men and the abuses that people can bring with their power to love relationships is fascinating. And my book is a little, it's more, you know, mine's about a producer with dementia, a very, very successful producer with dementia, and he has a wife, and he has a former wife, and he's disempowered, but he still has the accoutrements, and he's, you know, he's wealthy and he's well taken care of. but he's living in his own. He's living inside one of his screenplays, and he's kind of on the other side of all that, seeking, believing he's this character, an Athenian general, a fallen Athenian, a disgraced Athenian general, in after the Peloponnesian Wars, who's trying to find himself in that script, and he somehow has found that. In his life, that's his stance, and he sees his life that way. So he's kind of ruminating out, and his wives are, you know, they were kind of accessories in his life, but there was, you know, there was also a strong love relationship with both his ex-wife and his current wife, and but there's a touch of that where there's a vacancy to the relationship that he's had with both of them, and that's part of what he's seeking as this character in the screenplay. He's seeking more meaningful relationships in his life.
Well, it's interesting because you and I have both been in Los Angeles a long time, and I've always been fascinated by this culture. And I mean, I enjoy working in Hollywood. I love this town; otherwise, I wouldn't be here. But it is really tough on relationships. I mean, people's sense of self is so shaky in this town. And yet I absolutely believe in the power of love to transform people. And I think that's what people are looking for, essentially. It's just very hard to even identify it sometimes in this town.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sound familiar?
I think that artists, no, I think that people who, you know, creative people, in some way, they're seeking this kind of redemption communication. There's this thing from within that goes out, and the creative efforts that people, the juggernauts that they put themselves on, the different kinds of work that they do, it is about this kind of communication. And I think in some ways, personal relationships can be separate from that, but I think often they're bound into it, and they're bound up, and that sometimes people are, they don't have really good personal relationships, so they use their work to get those relationships, and it can be great. It can also be painful, I think.
So in your book, it sounds like the love he has for his wife is a key part of it.
It is and it isn't. I mean, there's an ex-wife and there's a current wife, and the current wife is, as she's dealing with him, he has a form of dementia, which, you know, so he's in a way she's living with a person who's disabled and who's emotionally completely vacant because he's living in this other world, and there were deficits in the relationship that are now worse because to get him to connect to their life is that much harder because their life never had as much connection. It was never ideal. It was okay, but it was never ideal. So, you know, and that's examined, it's palpable in the book. That he ends up finding meaningful relationships. He ends up reaching into his past and finding meaningful relationships through the fantasy world of the screenplay and through the screenwriter who provided him with this narrative that he's living in. It's also that the fact that his ambition for that script, he wanted the script to be his Oscar-winning script. He'd never won an Oscar. And the screenwriter eventually realizes that whether or not his film is on the screen, that the use that his story is having for the producer is very significant and has meaning. So in the day-to-day, he realizes that the story is living in this form of this, in the form that the producer has taken it to in his head, and that's satisfying. It's not the conventional goal that one has for a screenplay, but in the context of the story, it works for the screenwriter.
Well, you know, you said something about, you know, your character didn't get an Oscar, and I don't know if you read recently, there was an article by Gavin Pallone, I think in New York Magazine, about you know, why people aren't really watching the Oscar show is the way they used to, or with the same amount of devotion or anticipation. And this goes back to something you said at the beginning of this conversation about the nature of celebrity being diminished. And I think that the ultimate goal for a lot of writers I know, it used to be I want to win an Oscar, and it's not anymore. A lot of them now would
what
love
would
to.
Be the goal, what would be the goal now? They want to have a TV show, or you know,
they want to. Yeah, they want to be. They want to have a Sopranos. They want to be able to hit it out of the ballpark, both commercially and creatively, which is really rare. And have an impact, because a television show really can have such impact because of how many people it reaches. Same deal with Mad Men, even though it's on AMC. I mean, that is a show that gets a tremendous amount of respect. And it's really Matt Weiner's vision, you know? There wasn't a lot of tampering with that. That's what he wanted, and that's what's there.
You know, I think that that we're in a golden age in television. I think that the series form on cable and potentially on network as well. If the writer controls it, it's a writer's medium, and it's possible to have long-term control and to tell many stories and to tell long stories over many episodes. And if you can do it, if you do it right, then it's wonderful. But I think that still that medium has its, you know, there's great things about it. I think that it doesn't necessarily diminish the feature film form. I think the film form for now is still the paragon form to tell a story in 2 hours or 90 minutes or 2.5 hours and tell a complete story. I think that it's, you know, I wouldn't say one is better than the other. I think someone could do 12 or 18 episodes of, you know, Mad Men versus American Beauty. I don't know. I don't want to say which is better, but in the film form, the feature film form, you can really complete something and give it a more finite and polished form just because it's only an hour, because of the time limit, because you don't have to do an extra season of episodes, because the network would pay for it, which it tends to happen in this country.
Right.
But I think it's changing. I think that form and the way people watch film entertainment and the way film entertainment is being produced, I think that we're seeing an evolution. But I think the Oscars still matter. I mean, I think that it's been around for a long time, and it's not the same thing as it was, and there are many award shows. And I think that the studios are sort of they're in a kind of a cold period in terms of what they're willing to produce. And I think that may change a little bit. I think that we're going to see some more creative films coming from the studios just because they know the audiences won't go unless they see them. And that could be a while in coming, but I think that, you know, there's still a future there. And I think that to be able to write television, you have to know how to write a feature, or have to understand how the three-act form works in features to write television really well, I think. And maybe
I think learning the technique and the structure, that is really important. And by the way, I agree with you about, you know, the power of being able to tell a story in, you know, an hour and a half, a complete story, which is what, you know, you can do in a movie. And I was thinking that, you know, this past December, Bert Schneider died. And Bert Schneider had a company back, I guess, in the 70s called BBS. I think that's what it was called. And he came to town and started making movies at a time, which was not dissimilar to where the movie business is now, in the sense that there was, you know, a lot of these very expensive movies being made. And at that time, I think there's musicals and things like that. But it hadn't brought in a new audience. And then he started making these cool little movies like The Last Picture Show and Easy Rider and Fizey Pieces, and he sort of changed the nature of movie making for a moment in time in Hollywood. And it would be so great if there was another Bert Schneider at this point in time.
Yeah. Well, now we have, you know, the indie scene, and we have the DIY scene. I have a DIY project with the mumblecore director Joe Swanberg, and it's you know, he makes movies for $10,000. We have a project that, you know, it's a period project, and we're going to try and make it for $20,000, I think. And I think that there are exciting filmmakers, and there's a vibrancy at Sundance and South by Southwest, and many films which never get seen. It's almost like the audience, they need to figure out how to get those films to the audience at this point, because the studios aren't interested in that. But I think the point you made about the 70s, as the studios have tightened on to making very strictly genre films that are in,
right,
you know, five genres and nothing else, and sort of, you know, recycling things so much, it reminds me of when I was a kid in the 1950s, where the studios had become dinosaurs because of television, and they only made these, you know, they made biblical epics, and they made comedies, and they made westerns, and they made war films, and love stories, and there were very strict genres, and it's really returned to that in a way, and I think that it's, you know, it's all these things are cyclical, everything, you know. When there are bubbles and everybody thinks it's going to keep rising and stay the way it is, and then things go down and people think it's always going to be down, and it never is that way. Things, you know, it's more of a sine curve, and things go up and down. So I'm optimistic that there's going to be great stuff.
Well, you know, let me just sort of kind of bring things full circle back to the book world. You know, the kind of thing you're talking about, doing a little movie, you know, $10,000-$20,000, people are doing small little movies that are making Sundance vibrant, and people in the book world are doing it. You know, they're all kinds of different ways now to get your book out there, but the problem is how to find your audience, how you can reach people so they know that your product even exists, and that's
exactly
tough.
It's the same problem for the major publishers, unless someone is a, you know, major writer with a following. I mean, it's very difficult. I mean, for me, I find one person reading my book, you know, being able to hand the book to someone,
mm-hmm,
and then have them read it and respond to, eventually, you know, a month later, send me an email and say, you know, tell me what they thought of it. I find that to be magic and something, and very different from film. I mean, from mass media, I find that to be fascinating, and I think finding that audience and reaching out to readers, because there are many readers, and readers need to be, you know, that audience needs to be nurtured by the writer and needs to be sought out by the writer. This is my first novel, so I'm just, you know, going through the normal corporate methods of marketing, but also at the same time trying to figure out a strategy to find my readers and reach them and communicate with them.
Yeah, and I think, and I know that there are so many people out there who
are
avid readers, and you know, books can still change your life. I mean, there are books that have changed my life. My first novel, Cigarette Girl, changed my life because of people I met through it, the people who responded to it. In so many ways, it changed my life. So, I mean, I think books are really powerful. I like writing them. I like reading them. And but it's just at this point in time, we just have to find ways to find our readers out there are, in a way, people sharing the same sensibility or on the same journey. Yeah. So hopefully that somehow will all happen.
Yes, it will. Yes, it will. Readers will find it. It's a good book. Readers will find it, and they will pass it on to friends. And the reassuring thing about a book, the great thing about books, is that they're so transportable, and that the vision that you put on the page, a person will just take that material object and look at the words, and it will go directly into their brain. There are no devices, unless maybe they're using a Kindle or something like that, but really no intermediary projection devices or necessary to get to the vision that you put on the page. It's directly to the next person who reads it.
And your book is about to come out, right?
Yeah, it's coming out February 28th.
Wow. That's exciting.
It is exciting. It's my first book. Yeah, I'm working on another one and trying to work on some, you know, working on a screenplay and just, you know, but I'm finding it intoxicating to have the little saga that I wrote go directly to his audience. So that's the fun for me.
I love writing. I know there are people who hate, sitting down in front of a blank page, but to me that's, that's where I feel like I'm home.
Writing is a healing. Writing, when I started writing when I was very young, it's healing for me, and it's hard. It is hard. It's not always easy, and it's not easy to do something and make it decent. It's not automatic for me, but I'm a lifelong storyteller, and I'm still trying to. I love teaching screenwriting. I'm also trying to, figure out how to tell the story, how to shape the stories that I think of into something that's palpable for people.
And by the way, your book are now being really looked at closely by networks. That television is, looking to the book world for ideas for TV. So
that would be great.
It's a bridge.
Great.
Yeah.
Anyway, Carol, it's great. We've known each other. We came out to Los Angeles.
Don't even go with your past. I can't even hear about the past. No.
Many years.
I'm so neurotic about the past.
Ago, and we've had we've parallel journeys in this town, and here we are again with books coming out almost simultaneously. Now I'm a first time novelist. You're a best-selling novelist with, a couple under your belt already. So congratulations on the new one, and much success with it. And I'm looking forward to reading it myself. And it's great speaking with you.
Tom, thank you so much. It's true. It's been, a long journey here in L.A. But I think we both really love this city in spite of its craziness at times, and it's really been fun talking to you. So I'll read your book, you'll read mine, and we'll chat again.
Okay, take care.
You too. Bye.
Around me turned to rust. It's 'cause I built my life on sand, and I watched it crumble in the dust. Yeah, but it's alright, I'm okay. I wanna know how you are and what it's. Thank you.
but everything around me turned around. But I know all I have to do is sing, and I lift myself way off the ground.